Good morning, everyone. When God brought Israel out of Egypt, He knew that the people would need instructors in spiritual and moral matters. So the Levitical priesthood, also known as the sacerdotal order, was established. Their way of teaching was twofold, really. One, they taught directly by word of mouth. They taught the law of God, or at least that was what they were supposed to do, is teach God's law, just as we have teaching here in Bible studies and sermons. The second way was through the sacrifices and the rituals of the tabernacle and later the temple. The shedding of blood in the offerings reminded the people of the seriousness of sin, of the enormity of sin, and of the requirement of the shedding of blood for remission of sins, and of course, therefore, foreshadowing Jesus Christ and His redemptive work. The washings and the purification rites, we read through them, and they may seem meaningless or too ritualistic for us, but really those were ways of teaching the principle of holiness, of being set apart. God was telling the people, you are apart from other people. I have called you. I have given you my ways, my laws, and my commandments and statutes and judgments. And it also emphasized the holiness of God Himself. He's separate, different from all the other gods that are worshipped throughout the heathen nations. So there were two ways, essentially, that the sacerdotal order or the priesthood in Israel taught, through word of mouth and through the rituals and sacrifices and so forth. But during the time of the judges, the priesthood sank into a state of degeneracy, so a new moral order emerged in Israel. We call it the prophetic order. Now, I say new, but actually the germ of the prophetic order was given all the way back in the time of Moses in the law. If you would turn with me to Deuteronomy 13 and let's see the germ of the prophetic order. In other words, God is revealing through the law that there would be prophets, and these prophets would have a specific function where teaching and instructing the people on moral and ethical and spiritual matters were concerned. In Deuteronomy chapter 13, in verse 1, it says, if a prophet or a dreamer of dreams arises among you and gives you a sign or a wonder. See, this presupposes that there would be prophets. And Moses himself was a prophet. And he said that a prophet like himself would arise afterward. Of course, this ultimately referring to Jesus Christ. But the point being, it was made very clear that there would be prophets in Israel. So he says, if a prophet or a dreamer of dreams arises among you and gives you a sign or a wonder, and the sign or the wonder comes true concerning which he spoke to you, saying, let us go after other gods whom you have not known, and let us serve them, you shall not listen to the words of that prophet or that dreamer of dreams. So he's saying here, even if what he says comes true, you know, we think of the test of a true prophet, whether what he says comes true or not. If it comes true, he's a true prophet. If it doesn't, he's not a true prophet. There's more to the test than that. Even if it does come true, and yet he's saying, let's go after other gods, he says, don't listen to him. Don't listen at all. Or if he says, let's turn aside from this way that God has set forth before us through his law, God is saying, don't listen. But the point is, this presupposes that there would be prophets, people who would be teaching from the moral, ethical, and spiritual, teaching the moral, ethical, and spiritual matters that are found within the law. Also, in Deuteronomy chapter 18, we see a verse here that presupposes that there would be prophets. He says, verse 20, but the prophet who shall speak a word presumptuously in my name, which I have not commanded him to speak, or which he shall speak in the name of other gods, that prophet shall die. So the people themselves were not to tolerate false prophets, people who were coming along and teaching things other than what had already been revealed in the law, what had been revealed through Moses, and, of course, consistently taught by the sacerdotal order and later the prophetic order. But even though the germ of the prophetic order is given in the law, it was not developed. This order was not fully developed until the time of a man of God and a seer named Samuel. And without turning there, I'll just refer you to 1 Chronicles 6 through about chapter 9 or 10, where you find that Samuel was a Levite, and that his intention, or he was involved in the reforms of the sacerdotal order because they had sank into a state of degeneracy. And so his intention was to reform, that his reforms be permanent, not just temporary, not just limited to his own lifetime, but he wanted those reforms to be permanent. So it is apparent then that it was he who established companies or colleges of prophets. A lot of people think of prophets, they think of, they're mostly the prophets of Israel, were just people who came from here and yonder. Some shepherds, some fishermen, or whoever God decided to choose. And occasionally he did choose someone unexpectedly. An example is Amos, whom God called. He was a shepherd. He said, I'm not one of the sons of the prophets. I'm not a prophet. Why me? Now, occasionally that did happen, but it seems that for the most part, and generally speaking, the prophets of Israel came from the colleges of prophets. In other words, they had some training. They had been taught the teachings of the other prophets, the things that had already been revealed to the older prophets. And they were also taught in many other aspects. We'll get to that in a few moments. But let's look at how evidently the colleges of the prophets were established and how they continued in Israel. It's 1 Samuel chapter 19. 1 Samuel chapter 19. We read beginning in verse 18. Now David fled and escaped and came to Samuel at Ramah and told him all that Saul had done to him. And he and Samuel went and stayed in Naoth. And it was told Saul, saying, Behold, David is at Naoth in Ramah. And Saul sent messengers to take David, but when they saw the company of the prophets prophesying with Samuel standing and presiding over them, obviously he was the head prophet or the chief prophet or the president or whatever you want to call him, the Spirit of God came upon the messengers of Saul, and they also prophesied. You might read right over statements like that where you read about the company of the prophets, and later you'll see the sons of the prophets and all of that. And don't stop. You may not stop and think about what it's talking about. But this is talking about a school of prophets or a college that had been established, and it is evident that Samuel, in establishing his reforms and in his intentions to maintain those reforms throughout Israel's history, is the one who began these colleges of prophets. Now, they continued. It is evident that these colleges of prophets continued after the time of Samuel. Let's read a few other passages to see indications of that. Look at 2 Kings. 2 Kings chapter 2. And beginning in verse 2, And Elijah said to Elisha, Stay here, please, for the Lord has sent me as far as Bethel. But Elisha said, As the Lord lives, and as you yourself live, I will not leave you. So they went down to Bethel. Then the sons of the prophets who were at Bethel came out to Elisha and said to him, Do you know that the Lord will take away your master from over you today? And he said, Yes, I know. Be still. So here you have, previously we saw that there was a company of prophets in Naoth, in Ramah, and now we see in Bethel there is a company of prophets. They're called the sons of the prophets. This doesn't mean that necessarily that they were literally the sons of the prophets. Some probably were, but not all of them. It's that they were sons in the sense that they were the people who were being instructed. This is just they thought of the prophets as you see later that Elisha referred to Elijah as his father. And this is just in a spiritual sense or in a title of honor. He's certainly not violating anything that Jesus said about calling no man your father. Jesus was not so much concerned about the use of words as he was attitudes behind those words. So the sons of the prophets were these schools or colleges of prophets. And here we find that a college of prophets had been established in Bethel. Dropping on down to, just going over to chapter 4, and breaking into the context in verse 38, when Elisha returned to Gilgal, there was a famine in the land. As the sons of the prophets were sitting before him, he said to his servant, Put on the large pot and boil stew for the sons of the prophets. Here in Gilgal, there was another college of prophets. So it seems that these colleges of the prophets were spreading all over. You also find an indication of that in chapter 6 and verse 1. Now the sons of the prophets said to Elisha, Behold now, the place before you where we are living is too limited for us. Please let us go to the Jordan, and each of us take from there a beam, and let us make a place there for ourselves where we may live. So he said, go. So here you find another reference to the sons of the prophets. And it seems evident from looking at all these references that they were there were schools of prophets scattered here and there, had been established by older prophets. And so actually prophets were being trained. Look at also at 1 Kings chapter 18. 1 Kings chapter 18, this was in the time of Elijah, in the days of Jezebel, when she had killed the prophets, some of the prophets. It says, now it came about, this is verse 1, after many days, that the word of the Lord came to Elijah in the third year, saying, go show yourself to Ahab, and I will send rain on the face of the earth. So Elijah went to show himself to Ahab. Now the famine was severe in Samaria, and Ahab called Obadiah, who was over the household. Now Obadiah feared the Lord greatly. For it came about, when Jezebel destroyed the prophets of the Lord, that Obadiah took 100 prophets and hid them by 50s in a cave and provided them with bread and water. Conceivably, there had been several hundred prophets in the various schools of the prophets throughout the different areas at that period of time. But here Obadiah hides 100 of them by 50s in caves. And this apparently is what the book of Hebrews is referring to when it speaks of hiding in the caves and dens of the earth and so forth. At least it's referring to this, possibly among other things. But there you have a general idea from some of these passages, and we could put a lot more with that, that the prophets, there was not just a few prophets, there were many prophets. And there were schools of prophets. And you might wonder, well, what were the prophets taught? They were trained for the office, for the prophetic office, but what did that include? Ecstatic visions 101, or interpreting dreams, or how to go into a trance, how to converse with angels when you cross over to the other side? No, nothing like that. When we think of prophets, we think of Gene Dixon. We think of crystal balls and pyramids and astrology and all those things, but that's not what the word prophet entailed in ancient times. Actually, the term means to bubble forth, and really what it's talking about is an interpreter, one who speaks on behalf of God. Not only things that were directly revealed, certain prophets did receive the prophetic gift, and they did have things directly revealed, but also those who taught the things of God that had already been revealed. Things that are contained in the law, things they learned from the older prophets. And then from time to time, God would give special gifts, and they would have special revelations and perform miracles, and we'll see some examples of that later on. But obviously, in the schools or colleges of the prophets, they were taught the law, very thoroughly the law. They were also taught history, and they were taught how that those covenantal promises, meaning the covenantal blessings and the covenantal cursings, that you find in Deuteronomy 28 and elsewhere. They were taught about those and how those had played themselves out in Israel's history, so therefore they were able to go to the people and tell them, based upon history, what was going to happen in the future. And sometimes God would reveal things that specifically would happen going well on out into the future. But it's important to realize that a prophet's job was not merely to predict specific events in the future, but to speak of the things of God, the promises, the blessings and the cursings and so forth, and to see those things working themselves out in history and based upon history to warn the people. So that was the role of the prophet. It's not merely a seer. There's far more to it than just the ability to interpret dreams or to see visions or whatever. Apparently, as I said, most of the prophets came from the prophetic order, with few exceptions. One was Amos. So let's take a look at Amos chapter 7 briefly, and we'll see that Amos was one of those who didn't come from the schools of the prophets. Amos chapter 7, verse 14, we read, then Amos answered and said to Amaziah, I am not a prophet, nor am I a son of a prophet, for I am a herdsman and a grower of sycamore figs. But the Lord took me from following the flock, and the Lord said to me, go prophesy to my people Israel. So what he's saying, this simply supports the idea that there were schools of prophets and that the other people in Israel were aware of it. Because he says, essentially he's saying, well, God chose me out of the fields. I wasn't the son of a prophet, meaning I wasn't trained for this, but God told me anyway, go speak to my people Israel. So this simply shows us that you can't put God in a box and say he can only work here, he can't work there or elsewhere. God can choose whomsoever he will. But generally speaking, it does appear that most of the prophets came from the schools of the prophets. The prophets were honored as spiritual leaders by some, but they were despised by others. Let's look at some examples of how they were honored and why they were honored. Look at 1 Samuel chapter 16, 1 Samuel chapter 16, first couple of verses. Chapter 16, verse 1, now the Lord said to Samuel, remember Samuel was the prophet who apparently established the first college of prophets, how long will you grieve over Saul? You know, Saul was the first king. He was replaced to be replaced by David. Since I have rejected him from being king over Israel, fill your horn with oil and go. I will send you to Jesse the Bethlehemite, for I have selected a king for myself from among his sons. But Samuel said, how can I go? When Saul hears of it, he will kill me. And the Lord said, take a heifer with you and say, I have come to sacrifice to the Lord. It's interesting that a prophet was used to anoint the king. Obviously, you see the implications here. He was looked upon as a great spiritual leader, or a spiritual leader, I should say. And naturally, they would look to the spiritual leader, the one who represented God, who could teach the things of God, to anoint the king on God's behalf. So this reflects the spiritual leadership of Samuel. Interestingly, he is aware that Saul would have killed him. So at this point in his life, Saul is not prepared to accept. In other words, he's rejecting essentially what he says to us. He's rejecting God's rule over him because he's not accepting the means whereby God makes these choices, or through whom the means, particularly Samuel, through whom he made this choice in particular. In 2 Samuel chapter 12, we find quite a contrast on how David related to the prophets and how Saul related to the prophets, certainly how Ahab and Jezebel related to the prophets. This is after David had committed sin. Chapter 12, verse 1, it says, then the Lord sent Nathan, who was a prophet, to David, and he came to him and said, there were two men in one city, the one rich and the other poor. Now he's speaking a parable here. He said, the rich man had a great many flocks and herds, but the poor man had nothing except one little ewe lamb, which he bought and nourished, and it grew up together with him and his children. It would eat of his bread and drink of his cup and lie in his bosom, and it was like a daughter to him. Now a traveler came to the rich man, and he was unwilling to take from his own flock or his own herd to prepare for the wayfarer who had come to him. Rather, he took the poor man's ewe lamb and prepared it for the man who had come to David, who had come to him. David thinks this is a true story, and I'm sure that you and I can relate to it well, especially if you have pets and if you love your pets almost like family members. And you can imagine if you had a little lamb that you loved like that, and it was a pet, a household pet, and you held it up to your bosom and pet him at night and all that, and like you do, you probably do your little dogs, as we do our little dogs. And you can imagine somebody comes along and takes it away because they're not going to kill one of their own, and they kill it. And you can imagine how, well, it makes you mad to think about it, doesn't it? And it made David mad. Notice in verse 5, then David's anger burned greatly against the man, and he said to Nathan, as the Lord lives, surely the man who has done this deserves to die. Of course, he didn't know he was talking about David all along. And when he told David, now this is the important point, when he said, you are the man. Now, had that been Saul, how do you think he would have reacted to the prophet Nathan? It killed him. So you tricked me. I think he'd have killed him. What did David do? Verse 13, then David said to Nathan, I have sinned against the Lord. And Nathan said to David, the Lord also has taken away your sin. You shall not die. So So this was the difference between David and how he related to the prophets and how some of the other kings of Israel related to the prophets. But you see, David recognized that they were the spiritual leaders and the moral and ethical teachers in Israel. It's also important to realize that, you know, you think about Solomon and all of his wisdom as one of the kings in Israel. But you know, Solomon was educated by Nathan the prophet. Something to think about. Where did he get all that wisdom? Well, it came from God, but probably a great deal of it through Nathan the prophet. So the prophets were very important. The prophetic order was a very important order in Israel. In 2 Kings chapter 4, we see some of the activities of one of the prophets. 2 Kings chapter 4, let's take a look at that. Chapter 4, and beginning in verse... let me give you the context first. A woman's son had died. This was in the time of Elisha, who was Elijah's successor. Verse 22, then she called her husband and said, "Please send me one of the servants and one of the donkeys that I may run to the man of God and return." The man of God she's referring to is Elisha the prophet. And he said, "Why will you go to him today? It is neither new moon nor Sabbath." And she said, "It will be well." What does this imply here? It implies that normally she did go to the prophet on the new moons and the Sabbaths. Why? Well, for assemblage. They had assemblies. In other words, Elisha was conducting Sabbath services. He was a teacher. He was recognized as a spiritual and moral leader. In verse 42, it says, "Now a man came from Baal-Shalisha and brought the man of God," meaning Elijah, "bread of the first fruits, 20 loaves of barley and fresh ears of grain in a sack. And he said, 'Give them to the people that they may eat.'" Why did he bring these to Elisha? It was obviously because he recognized him as a community leader, because he was a spiritual leader. And possibly, it's just a second possibility, it could be that he gave them to Elisha, who is a man of God, who represented God to the people, because for the same reason that Abraham gave the tenth to Melchizedek, simply as honoring God. He was just showing God, he was honoring God through giving to one of his servants who was doing God's work. And continuing on in 2 Kings, in 2 Kings chapter 5, beginning in verse, well, let's just summarize the account here. There was a certain Syrian named Naaman, who was the captain of the army of the king of Aram, and he was very well known. He was very well liked, very well respected, and yet he had a problem. He was also a leper. And so one day Naaman's wife's servant, who happened to be an Israelite, said, "I wish my master would go to Samaria to the prophet who resides there, and he would cure him." And so when Naaman heard about this, he did go. He requested of his king that he write a letter to the king in Israel. And so he did go, and finally he did come to Elisha. Taking up the account in verse 10, "And Elisha sent a messenger to him, saying, 'Go and wash in the Jordan seven times.'" This is chapter 5 and verse 10. "Wash yourself in the Jordan seven times, and your flesh shall be restored to you, and you shall be clean." But Naaman was furious and went away and said, "Behold, I thought he will surely come out to me and stand and call on the name of the Lord his God and wave his hand over the place and cure the leper." You know, that's the way he envisioned it. That's the way he wanted it to happen. But it was going to happen a little bit differently. And then he goes on to say, verse 12, "Are not Abana and Pharpar, the river of Damascus, better than all the waters of Israel? Could I not wash in them and be clean?" So he turned and went away in a rage. Then his servants came near and spoke to him and said, "My father, had the prophet told you to do some great thing, would you not have done it? How much more then when he says to you, 'Wash and be clean'?" So he went down and dipped himself seven times in the Jordan, according to the word of the man of God, and his flesh was restored like the flesh of a little child, and he was clean. When he returned to the man of God with all his company, and came and stood before him, he said, "Behold now, I know that there is no God in all the earth but in Israel. So please take a present from your servant now." But he said, as the Lord lives before whom I stand, I will take nothing. And he urged him to take it, but he refused. And Naaman said, if not, please let your servant at least be given 2 mules load of earth, for your servant will no more offer burnt offerings, nor will he sacrifice to other gods but to the Lord. So this miracle changed Naaman. And what's interesting about this is Jesus refers to this very occurrence. He asks essentially how many people were healed in the time of Elijah of leprosy. Of course, the Pharisees, the religious leaders of his time, claimed, well, if we'd have been back then, we wouldn't have killed the prophets like some of them did. We wouldn't be like Ahab and Jezebel or Saul or many of the others who killed the prophets, who ignored what the prophets had to say. But Jesus is pointing out how many lepers he had healed, and yet they still wanted to kill him. So he said, you're the children of them who killed the prophets. And we'll get to that a little later as we have time. But we do find many marvelous works that the prophets did, not only as spiritual leaders, but as people whom God performed miracles through. And it's interesting as you read these various accounts, from the raising of the dead to the healing of lepers and many other miracles, that Jesus did the very same things, only in greater magnitude. And just as these prophets taught in their schools of prophets, Jesus himself had a school of prophets. They're called apostles, but they were prophets in the sense in which the term is used in the scripture. They were prophets, and it was a school, a college of prophets. And just as the prophets of old, Jesus taught them the principles of God's law, as you see very clearly in Matthew 5, 6, and 7, and other places. We find many other examples of things that the prophets did, of miracles that were performed under their hands. You see the raising of dead, both in the case of Elisha and Elijah. Remember how that Elijah stretched himself over the apparently dead body of the widow's son that had given him shelter, and he was raised to life. Elisha did the same thing. He was raised to life. That's what the book of Hebrews is talking about when it says the dead received, or I should say women received their dead raised to life again. And so many other things were like this were performed. But all people, even though sometimes it got good results, such as in the case of Naaman, people saw the works of God through the prophets and oftentimes repented, but there were many there who did not honor the prophets as men of God. Let's take a look at that in an example of this in 2 Kings chapter 2, back up to chapter 2. This is something that is depicted in art. It's something that's a story that's often told, probably in Sunday school classes, or it's at least a well-known story, and I think it's something that a lot of people misunderstand, at least if you look at some of the art depictions. When you see little children who are making fun of an old bald-headed guy who's going up some steps or going up a road or something like that, you think that that's, you know, this is a depiction of what we're about to read here. It's in 2 Kings chapter 2, and let's take up the account in verse 23. Then he, and this is talking about Elisha, who succeeded Elijah after Elijah was taken up into the sky, that he went up from there to Bethel, and as he was going by the way, this translation says young lads, the King James says, I think it says little children or something like that, little children, came out from the city and mocked him and said to him, go up, you bald head! Go up, you bald head! Now, what comes to mind when you read that, especially as it's worded in the King James Version? I picture these little bitty children out there. You hear the cute little giggles, and they're out there playing, and they see this funny-looking old guy, the mean-looking guy, you know, has this expression on his face, and he's bald-headed, and they turn and look, and they laugh at him because he looks funny, and say, go on up, bald head! Maybe he's going up, you know, up the road. Maybe there's an upward grade, and he's going up the road, or maybe he's going up some steps. They're going up, bald head. And notice what happens here. When he looked behind him and saw them, he cursed them in the name of the Lord. Think this ornery old guy, old bald-headed guy, turns around and rush off, you know, curses them for calling him, for making fun of him. Then two female bears came out of the woods and tore up 42 lads of their number. I think certain ministers in times past have used this as an example of how you're not supposed to make fun of them.
I'll bet you the ones that have used that, most of them have a receding hairline, receded about as far as the crown or whatever. But really, that's not what it's about at all. First of all, the term translated little children, as scholars have pointed out, could be rendered young men. And if you look at how these terms are used, you could see it could be people, young people, young men, anywhere from the ages of 12 to 30. So probably it was a group of young men there. I would say older than 7 or 8. They weren't playing with little toys in the dirt. They were young men. Why did they call him Baldhead? Was he an old man? Well, he lived some 60 years after Elijah was taken up. So obviously, Elijah had already been taken up. So it probably Elisha at this point was about 25 or so. So he wouldn't have been an old man as he's often depicted. Would he have been bald? Men in the in that part of the world, generally speaking, well, baldness was rare, very rare. And usually baldness was associated with a disease such as leprosy. So the term bald head is not a description of his appearance. It's a term of scorn. In our language, it would be essentially the same as saying, "You freak, you know, stay away from me. You have some kind of disease, some kind of contagious disease. Stay away." And so this was a term of scorn. Essentially, what they were saying is, "Go on up, you freak, or you bald head, you disease-infested thing, you." It's just a term of scorn. In all probability, Elisha had a full head of hair. Has nothing to do with his hair. It's just a term of scorn. Now, why did they say, "Go up"? Well, look what happened sometime previous to this event, back in verse 11, when Elisha and Elijah are walking along. It says, "Then it came about as they were going along and talking, and behold, there appeared a chariot of fire and horses of fire that separated the two of them. And Elijah went up by a whirlwind to heaven." Elijah went up. Obviously, word of this got around, that Elijah had been taken up, and given the unbelieving nature of many people, a lot of people ridiculed the idea. You know, probably they said, "Yeah, the prophet has run off again. Real brave soul, isn't he?" No, he's really a coward. He's run off again, but now word's going around that he was taken up into the sky by a great miracle. And so they probably ridiculed the idea and didn't believe it. So what are these young men saying when Elisha, who is known to be Elijah's companion and successor, has come along? They say, "Why don't you go on up too, like Elijah did, supposedly? Go on up, you bald head." And so really they were scorning him, and not just a bunch of little children out there making fun of an old bald-headed guy. They were ridiculing him to scorn, and essentially what they were doing is saying, "We don't believe what you stand for. So why don't you go on up like your master did, supposedly?" In other words, get out of our sight. So what they were really doing were they were rejecting God. And he didn't turn around and curse the way you and I might turn around and curse if somebody called us a name, or some of us would, I suppose. What he was doing was simply pronouncing the judgments that God had already rendered. And you can read it for yourself in Leviticus 26 and verses 21 and 22, where that those who turn away from him, those who dishonor him, then he says he'll send the wild beast or the beast of the field into their cities and kill their children and their livestock and so forth. And really, this is also prophetic. This is prophetic. It was just a very powerful way of demonstrating what God would do in the future of those people when he would send the wild beasts known as the Assyrians to take those people away. So this was just a foretaste and prophetic of that event that was yet future. Sometimes the prophets were called upon to do some strange things in order to get the point across. You know, a while ago, as I mentioned, the Levitical priesthood acted out the truths of God on the stage of the tabernacle and later of the temple. And it seems that sometimes the prophets themselves were called upon to act out the message that God had for the people of Israel in order to make the point extremely vivid and clear. Look at Ezekiel chapter 12 for an example of that. Ezekiel chapter 12, and you'll see that the prophets sometimes were called upon to do things that we would certainly wouldn't want to have to do. Things that might be a little bit embarrassing for us, or things that might be terribly difficult to do. In chapter 12, and beginning in verse 7, I'll just take up the account there. Ezekiel says, "And I did so as I had been commanded. By day I brought out my baggage like the baggage of an exile." God had told him to do this. "Then in the evening I dug through the wall with my hands. I went out in the dark and carried the baggage on my shoulder in their sight." God had told him to do this. Take your baggage out there and then dig through the wall and come out, you know, the baggage as if you're going into exile, and then come out with something over your face so you can't see the land, and then take your baggage in their sight. And the point of this, of course, that he was acting out something that God was going to do. Verse 8, In the morning the word of the Lord came to me, saying, "Son of man, has not the house of Israel, the rebellious house, said to you, 'What are you doing?' Say to them, 'Thus says the Lord God, this burden concerns the prince in Jerusalem, as well as all the house of Israel who are in it. Say, I am assigned to you, as I have done, so it will be done to them. They will go into exile, into captivity. And the prince who is among them will load his baggage on his shoulder in the dark and go out. They will dig a hole through the wall to bring it out. He will cover his face so that he cannot see the land with his eyes. I shall also spread my net over him, and he will be caught in my snare, and I shall bring him to Babylon in the land of the Chaldeans, yet he will not see it, though he will die there." So Ezekiel was called upon to act out this event. Now, if we see somebody doing this, we realize we live in a different culture, and see somebody doing things like this today, we know that they're a nut. But in this case, and especially certain ones knowing that he was a prophet, they understood that this was a very powerful way to get that message across, by demonstrating it through an act. In Ezekiel 4, there's another example. Just summarize it without reading the whole thing. But Ezekiel, with a model of Jerusalem before him, had to lay on his left side for 390 days, a day for each year, concerning the iniquity of the house of Israel, and then 40 days on his right side. Seems like a rather strange thing to do. And especially if done in the sight of other people, they wonder, what in the world are you doing just laying there, you know, for all that period of time with this model in front of you? But Ezekiel, of course, had to act out what God was going to do, and it certainly was a very powerful way of doing so. But sometimes it got rather embarrassing for the prophets, some of the things they were required to do in acting out the judgments, the decrees of God. In Isaiah chapter 20, if you turn there briefly, it's a very short chapter, beginning in verse 1. "In the year that the commander came to Ashdod, when Sargon the king of Assyria sent him, and he fought against Ashdod and captured it, at that time the Lord spoke through Isaiah the son of Amoz, saying, 'Go and loosen the sackcloth from your hips and take your shoes off your feet.' And he did so, going naked and barefoot. And the Lord said, 'Even as my servant Isaiah has gone naked and barefoot 3 years as a sign and token against Egypt and Cush, so the king of Assyria will lead away the captives of Egypt and the exiles of Cush, young and old, naked and barefoot, with buttocks uncovered, to the shame of Egypt.'" You know, if God called upon me to do a thing like that, I'd have to ask him, could I have 1 year first? For dieting and working out, of course. But that would be a terribly embarrassing thing to have to do, to act out what is going to happen prophetically in order to get the point across. Hosea is another example. Hosea chapter 1, verse 1, "The word of the Lord which came to Hosea the son of Beeri," or Beeri, "during the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah, and during the days of Jeroboam the son of Joash, king of Israel. When the Lord first spoke through Hosea, the Lord said to Hosea, 'Go take to yourself a wife of harlotry and have children of harlotry, for the land commits flagrant harlotry, forsaking the Lord.'" So Hosea was to go and marry a prostitute and how children, by this prostitute, in symbolizing God and Israel and the current relationship with Israel and their own harlotries. Now, he had to act this out. It certainly something that affected his life there. Well, this goes on to say, verse 3, so he went and took Gomer, the daughter of Diblaim, and she conceived and bare him a son. It goes on to tell the names of his children and what these names signified prophetically. But the point is, he had to interrupt his life and go and marry a prostitute in depicting this problem between God and Israel, the problem with Israel, of course, in their relationship with God. And, you know, it's bad enough the poor guy had to go marry a prostitute, but for crying out loud, one named Gomer. This would sound like a Mayberry wedding going on here or something. But this was, again, here was something that a prophet was required to do in acting out the things that God had in mind and the lessons that God wanted to get across to his people. Well, let's go over to the New Testament and see the significance of the prophets from the perspective of the New Testament writers. Look over to Ephesians chapter 2, first of all. Ephesians chapter 2. The Apostle Paul says in verse 17, and he came and preached peace to you which were far off. He's talking about the Gentiles, and peace to those who were near, talking about the Jews. For through him we both Jew and Gentile, have one access in one Spirit to the Father. So then you Gentiles, are no longer strangers and aliens, but you are fellow citizens with the saints and are of God's household, having been built upon the foundation of the apostles and prophets. And this is not just talking about what some people would call the New Testament prophets. It's talking about the prophets in general, meaning all of those prophets who were trained in the schools of the prophets, who went prophesying in Israel, teaching God's law, those who were slain because of the things they were teaching, including Isaiah, Ezekiel, Daniel, all the other prophets. This is the foundation of the New Testament church, Christ Jesus himself being the cornerstone, in whom the whole building being built, being fitted together, is growing into a holy temple in the Lord. So the prophets have a very important place right at the foundation of the New Testament church. John the Baptist, who was the Elijah who preceded Jesus' first coming, was a prophet. Jesus himself was a prophet, as we're told very clearly in Scripture. Let's look at what Jesus says in Matthew chapter 23. Matthew chapter 23, he makes references to the prophets. Chapter 23, beginning in verse 29, he says, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you build the tombs of the prophets and adorn the monuments of the righteous, and say, if we had been living in the days of our fathers, we would not have been partners with them in shedding the blood of the prophets. Consequently, you bear witness against yourself that you are the sons of those who murdered the prophets. Fill up then the measure of the guilt of your fathers. You serpents, you brood of vipers, how shall you escape the sentence of Gehenna? Therefore, behold, I am sending you prophets." So, he's still sending prophets. "Behold, I am sending you prophets and wise men and scribes. Some of them you will kill and crucify. Some of them you will scourge in your synagogues and persecute from city to city, that upon you may fall the guilt of all the righteous blood shed on earth, from the blood of righteous Abel to the blood of Zechariah, the son of Berechiah, whom you murdered between the temple and the altar." And then he goes on to say, "Truly I say to you, all these things shall come upon this generation." And he's referring here to what happened to that generation. In fact, the fall of Jerusalem, and what contributed greatly to that was the corruption that was there. So these people were killers of the prophets, the sons of them who killed the prophets. And they demonstrated this over and over, because Jesus himself came doing all the signs, only in a far greater way, that the prophets did. And what did they do to him? Well, they killed him. And before they killed him, they certainly plotted to have him killed. So obviously, had they been living in the time of the forefathers, they would have contributed to the killing of the prophets then as well. Are there prophets today? Well, Jesus said he would send prophets. And once you understand that a prophet is not necessarily someone who receives special revelations from God, but someone who teaches the things of God and someone who has been given that gift, then yes, in that sense, there are prophets. There have always been prophets. There'll be prophets in the future. In Acts, the second chapter, Acts chapter 2, we read about, I guess what we could call the fruit, the real fruit of the work of the prophets. Acts chapter 2, on the day of Pentecost, when the Holy Spirit came, Peter related what was happening to a prophecy given by Joel. Verse 16, he says, "This is what was spoken through the prophet Joel." And from beginning in verse 17, he quotes the prophet. He says, "And it shall be in the last days, God says, that I will pour forth my spirit upon all mankind," meaning not restricted just to one race of people or one family of people, but there will be people from all the represented, all the families of the earth that will receive his spirit. "And your sons and your daughters shall prophesy. And your young men shall see visions, and your old men shall dream dreams, even upon my bondslaves." Now he's quoting from the Septuagint. The Hebrew version renders it, "even upon the bondslaves." In the Septuagint, it's changed to "my," because apparently the translators didn't like the idea that God would pour out his spirit upon slaves. But what he's saying is, even upon the slaves, both men and women. In other words, this is how universal the pouring out of the Spirit will be. "And they shall prophesy. And I will grant wonders in the sky above and signs in the earth beneath," and so forth. Now, this was what happened there on the day of Pentecost, of course, was a forerunner of an ultimate and final fulfillment of that prophecy. And you can't help but wonder what lies in the days ahead between now and the day of the Lord. Will we see such a thing again? Will we see the young men and the young women and even the servants and people from all walks of life prophesying? Let's turn over to Hebrews 11, Hebrews chapter 11. And I think we see the most important lesson that we can understand from studying the lives of the prophets and all of their works and the things they did, because we see the underlying motive, why they did what they did. Hebrews 11, of course, is called the faith chapter. We read about Abel, Enoch, Noah, then Abraham and Sarah, and Isaac and Jacob, and even Rahab the harlot. And it goes on to say in verse 32, after reading all about all of these and showing that these are examples of faith, he says, "And what more shall I say? For time will fail me if I tell of Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, of David, and Samuel, and the prophets." So the prophets are set forth in the book of Hebrews as an example of faith. And of course, as you look at their lives, you can see indeed they were men of faith. To do the things that they were required to do obviously was a demonstration that they believed God, just as Abraham had believed God. So they were men of faith. And we find that they too are going to be in the kingdom of God, just as Abraham and Isaac and Jacob will be there. They'll be there in the kingdom. As certainly as they're the life, that they're very important to the foundation of the New Testament church, we couldn't expect otherwise. And there are many scriptures that confirm that indeed the prophets will be there. It goes on to say, verse 33, "who by faith conquered kingdoms, performed acts of righteousness, obtained promises, shut the mouths of lions, quenched the power of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, from weakness were made strong, became mighty in war, put foreign armies to flight. Women received back their dead by resurrection," referring undoubtedly to the resurrections that occurred in the time of Elijah and Elisha. "And others were tortured, not accepting their release, in order that they might obtain a better resurrection," that is, one better than the ones those women received back in the time of Elijah and Elisha, meaning one from which there is no or that I should say one which does not involve death again. Those people went ahead, they died again. They lived out their lives and they died. But this is one, of course, that they sought, showing that the prophets understood that there was a future resurrection. And they understood the concept of immortality in God's kingdom. And others experienced mockings and scourgings, yes, also chains and imprisonment. They were stoned, they were sawn in two, they were tempted, they were put to death with the sword. They were made. They went about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, ill-treated, men of whom the world was not worthy, wandering in deserts and mountains and caves and holes in the ground. Certainly included in this would be those prophets that Obadiah hid in the caves. And all these, having gained approval through their faith, did not receive what was promised, because God had provided something better for us, so that apart from us, they should not be made perfect. That apart from us, you see how that we are related to the prophets. A lot of people go around looking for their roots, go around and seeing what kind of birds, I suppose, are roosting on the family tree's limbs. And it's an interesting study to go to find out where you come from and who your ancestors were what kind of different peoples you may have come from. Whether there's American Indian or Irish or whatever is in your background. But you know, when we read the story of the prophets, in a very real way, we're reading of our own family tree. We're reading of our own ancestors, the people from which we descended in one sense. Because if we are God's people, then we are indeed children of the prophets. And whether we live in a time, to see a time when the prophetic gift will be poured out in its fullness once again, whether we'll live to see the raising of the dead as Elijah and Elisha and certainly as Jesus and the apostles saw, or whether we see the mighty miracles that certainly would be a shot in the arm for so many of us, I believe, and definitely a witness to a dying world, and I do believe a time like that is coming, but whether we see it or not, there's something that we need to keep in mind, a vision we need to have, that we will join the rest of the family, because apart from us, they should not be made perfect. We'll join the rest of the family on that sea of glass in that day when you and I will stand side by side, shoulder in shoulder, alongside the prophets.